I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Accused Bosnian Serb war criminal Radovan Karadzic was hiding in plain sight. He was captured in a suburb of the Serbian capital of Belgrade yesterday after 13 years on the run. He's accused of masterminding the brutal siege of Sarajevo in the 1990s, as well as the slaughter of 8,000 men and boys at Srebrenica, Europe's worst massacre since World War II. Karadzic led a campaign of ethnic cleansing during the 1992-95 Bosnian War that led to fierce fighting between Bosnian Serbs, Muslims, and Catholics. Today, a judge ordered his transfer to the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague to face genocide charges. That leaves one other major war criminal at large, military leader Ratko Mladic. Neil MacDonald is a reporter for the Financial Times of London, based in Belgrade. Neil, Karadzic has been called the Osama bin Laden of the Balkans. How did he evade capture for so long?
Well, that's a good question. It was Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. diplomat, who called him that. He obviously evaded capture with collusion of some people helping him, but he seems to have just brazenly adopted a new identity and didn't raise any suspicions about himself.
The AP has quoted his landlord saying that his disguise was quite convincing. Describe him. Pictures are starting to come over. What are you seeing there? What does
he
look like?
Well, I don't remember what he looked like during the war. You know, he's clean-shaven, but with kind of floppy sort of grayish hair. In the latest pictures, as this alternative medicine practitioner in Belgrade, he's got sort of long white hair and a long beard, sort of yogi-ish looking, and really not recognizable as Radovan Karadzic.
We understand he was found in a monastery, that he was wearing a hassock.
There are at least three conflicting stories going around. The most prevalent one seems to be that he was on a public bus outside Belgrade, on his way to vacation on the Croatian coast. But actually, the Serbian authorities have been a bit reserved about disclosing the details of the arrest, saying that because they're still trying to capture Ratko Mladic, the wartime military commander under Karadzic, all they said was he was captured near Belgrade while changing locations.
You were saying that many in the former Yugoslavia have long believed that if Serb leaders wanted to capture him, they could have. Why now? We know Serbia is trying to enter the European Union. Is there a quid pro quo here?
Yeah, there certainly is. Some Serbian politicians have been pushing to put EU entry ahead of sort of nationalist questions from the past for quite some time. But the pro-EU parties really turned the tide in elections a couple of months ago. They've recently formed a government. Really, it just seems like the balance of power in Belgrade has finally tipped against hardline nationalism. You know, a lot of people have very mixed feelings about things, but the country is moving in the direction of the EU, and so the fugitive war crime suspects are practically the only obstacle now for starting EU accession talks. Generally, it was more expected that Mladic would be captured first, but now with Karadzic's arrest, you know, there'll be a lot of pressure to capture Mladic.
This is Ratko Mladic, the other on-the-run accused war criminal. You mentioned, though, so the government in Serbia has tipped from nationalist party to a more centrist party, but what's happening on the streets and on media there? How's this playing out? How big is it? How are people reacting?
Well, it's certainly a big story, but people are mostly reacting with kind of quiet relief, I think. You know, mixed feelings about whether the tribunal is fair to Serbs, because more Serbs have faced trial, and the feeling here is that all ethnic groups were responsible, and somehow the post-conflict justice process is weighted against Serbs. Karadzic wasn't such a hero to many people. Mladic is a figure who's sort of stood up in people's minds as a hero much more since the war.
But we do understand that, you know, Karadzic had become something of a folk hero among nationalist Serbs. His face is on T-shirts. He'd become a symbol of the lost greater Serbia that he was going to achieve through his ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, that's true. But the momentum has shifted against that sort of thinking just in the last couple of months. The undecided status of Kosovo up until February fed this kind of reaction in Serbia. Now there's still sort of bitterness about Kosovo's declaration of independence, but at the same time a growing feeling that this shouldn't hold up Serbia's progress towards the EU.
What's next for Karadzic?
He's in the detention cell at the Serbian Special Court in Belgrade, and I think he has 3 days to appeal. So basically the judge there has given the order for him to be extradited to The Hague, but he'll that probably won't happen till Friday. And then I guess he'll have a hearing there, and I don't know exactly how the whole trial process will unfold, but I guess we can expect sort of, you know, something concluding with a verdict in the next 2 years or so.
Neil MacDonald of the Financial Times, speaking to us from Belgrade. Neil, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, let's remind ourselves. Bosnia-Herzegovina was one of six republics that made up Yugoslavia. Communist dictator Tito held that country together during his reign. But after his death in 1980, long simmering nationalist sentiments began to break the country apart. First, Slovenia and Croatia declared independence in 1991. Then in 92, the Muslim-led government of Bosnia followed suit. Bosnian Serb nationalists, led by Karadzic and others, responded by declaring war. They took control of more than half of the country and drove out other ethnic groups. Well, New York Times journalist John Burns covered that Bosnian war. John, Karadzic emerged as Yugoslavia was falling apart, but he didn't come from the military. First, where did he come from?
You know, he was a weirdly Balkan character, a man who in youth was twisted and tortured, if you will, by the history that he had lived. He was the son of a Chetnik, a Serb nationalist, who fought the Nazis and then the communists in Yugoslavia in the 1940s. His father went to jail. He was raised by his mother in Montenegro, which is the absolute heartland of hardline Serbian nationalism. He went to Sarajevo in Bosnia, a much more sophisticated. He came from a very poor background, and he was bright enough to get himself into medical school, graduated as a psychiatrist, specializing, would you believe it, in paranoia. He fancied himself as a poet and wrote some very strange, weird poetry, much of which prefigured the destruction that he visited on Bosnia later. And history moved towards him in the sense that Yugoslavia, of course, after Tito, began to break apart. The Serbs began to look to radical options, and he became the, if you will, he became the Pied Piper of the Serbian nationalist cause in Bosnia, and was able then, with an army of paramilitary thugs, to act out his delusions, with a catastrophic cost, of course, to Bosnia.
Well, help us with that. I mean, because what was it about him? How did he go from psychiatrist who, yes, had this painful childhood? His father was jailed, actually, eventually. He had, as you said, a lonely, impoverished childhood. But how did he bring people to follow him?
Well, in order to understand that, you'd have to cast yourself into the situation that developed in Yugoslavia, where all kind of snake oil salesmen emerged in the wake of Tito. He was truly, as I've already said, delusional, preposterous character. And it was an astonishing thing to witness how people who seemed otherwise quite sane embraced this lunatic vision that he and Ratko Mladic, the Serbian general who joined with him in the enterprise of ethnic cleansing, propagated. So, you know, one felt dealing with those two men, witnessing what was going on in Bosnia, as if you'd gone through the looking glass into a kind of a charnel house.
Well, in fact, you did go to the Panorama, which is the converted ski hotel. You write about it in today's paper, that Karadzic used as a headquarters. And you write that he'd like to hold court there. What was his vision? What was he orchestrating from that ski hotel?
I came back from my first experience of ethnic cleansing in eastern Bosnia, where I'd seen people machine-gunned, men and boys, in a village square in eastern Bosnia, and their families, women and children, driven out of town up over the mountains. And I was telling them about these miseries that I'd witnessed. Within 24 or 48 hours, he was sitting at his desk in his ski hotel headquarters, sipping cognac and smoking a Cuban cigar. And it was the first time I'd heard, by the way, when I witnessed it, ethnic cleansing. I didn't even translate it correctly to begin with. None of us knew what it meant. So I was talking to him about what I'd seen, and he said I'd got it completely wrong. I totally misunderstood. These were not people being driven from their homes. They were people who had been liberated by the crusaders of Serbian nationalism to go home. He said they're going home because now they can go across the mountains to Muslim-majority areas where they, Muslims, who were never happy, he said, living where they were on the banks of the Drina River in eastern Bosnia among Serbs, and that they should and would celebrate and thank him and Mladic for what they had done. And I thought at that moment, there's no limit to the evil that this man, banal in a way as he was, will visit on Bosnia. And so it proved to be. You know, as we know now, 150,000 to 200,000 people died, 20,000 women were raped, and ultimately in 1995, of course, as these people always do, they go to an extremity, and the extremity was what happened at Srebrenica, in which nearly 8,000 men and boys were executed, and that, of course, speeded the end, because the United States, within a month or two of that, acted decisively with air power to end the Serbian nationalist enterprise in Bosnia.
You described that scene where you sat with him and he lectured you like an errant student, is how you write it, as Lilliputian, but he had huge, huge impact. You know, he was the psychiatrist, but what would you say he was acting out? Was it, you know, an opportunity to do what his father couldn't do against the Nazis, but he could do against the Muslims?
Well, that was certainly part of it. I mean, insofar as there is a rational explanation for this, but I do think that you know, he was it's a cliche, but he really was a mad psychiatrist. I sat with him in a cafe in Belgrade at the height of the ethnic cleansing in 1992, he talked to me about his practice in paranoia and how his job was to uproot delusion and to return people to reality. And I said to him, but it seems to me that what you're doing in your ethnic cleansing is exactly the opposite, that you are indeed spreading and thriving on paranoia. No, he said, I am completely based in reality. He was something of a figure of fun before he became the killer that he was during that period. He was a figure of fun in Sarajevo. And that, who knows what that may have done. His poetry was mocked by critics in the local newspapers. He hired halls at the university to read his poetry to largely empty auditoriums. And I think he had been repeatedly in life humiliated by, you know, the fact that his father was disgraced and jailed, that he grew up poor. He came to the cosmopolitan city of Sarajevo, where he was treated as something of a provincial hick. I think if you want an explanation for what became of Radovan Karadzic, you have to look as much to personal history as to perceptions, his perceptions of the tortured history of Bosnia and of Yugoslavia. But the two came together, of course, in this combustible and ultimately murderous mix that we've already spoken of.
Well, we're talking about the arrest of Radovan Karadzic with John Burns of the New York Times, who, as we heard, witnessed men and boys slaughtered under Karadzic's direction. Karadzic, as we said, was a psychiatrist who became the leader of the Bosnian Serbs during the war in the Balkans. But he, as we also said, also fancied himself a poet. We'll speak to an American poet who met with him, but we'll also have more with John Burns. Oh, later today, a brain surgeon, something you ought to know, but that's later. Back in a minute with John, here and now. We've been looking at the fallout from the capture of Bosnian Serb wartime leader Radovan Karadzic with John Burns on the New York Times. And John, what do you think will be Karadzic's place in world history?
Well, it has to be very careful in drawing analogies because, of course, the people who spring to mind, delusional characters, men with a tortured sense of history and an inexhaustible store of hatred, who do we think of? We think of Adolf Hitler, perhaps of Stalin, but these were people who killed not tens of thousands, but millions of people. And so I think there are early limits to, you know, to where, to the comparisons, the ordination that you can make. I think what you can say is that in our generation, in our time, there have been very few people quite as evil in their effects as Radovan Karadzic, and that the bringing of his transit to The Hague, and to, as one may expect, a war crimes trial, will be an extremely important event, and not just for the victims, the millions of victims, either as, you know, those who died or those who were driven, who were refugees across Europe, but to, if you will, the psyche of Europe, let this not happen again.
We've heard muted response from Serb nationalists. There were some protests, but as we heard from a reporter in Belgrade, there's a sense of it's time to move on, to join the European Union, some relief that at his capture. What about the survivors, the widows of Srebrenica?
My guess, and one can only guess because so few of us, and certainly I, have not suffered what they have suffered. I think that nothing will bind up the wounds that they have suffered. But that's not to say that they will not find some, if you will, they'll find some healing in what we're now going to see in a trial, assuming that he does reach The Hague and that he does go on trial. But, of course, there is the equal and opposite reaction, and that is to say that there is still a strong Serbian rump in Serbia, in Bosnia, in Montenegro. It was this rump that made it possible for him, and it's more than a rump. It was well seated in the government of Yugoslavia over the last 12 years when he's been a Pimpernel, a fugitive. It was these people who made it possible for him to evade capture, and they're not going to give up. There are still other war criminals, principal amongst them General Mladic, at large. And of course, Serbia is petitioning for entry into the European Union. And it seems to me this is far from a finished business, and that we need, and I'm talking now about the West, the civil societies of the West, need to make it very clear indeed that the surrender of Radovan Karadzic is not the end of this story, and that they really have to clear out the Augean stables before they can be seriously considered for membership in the family of the West.
John Burns of the New York Times, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We want to take just a couple of minutes now to talk about Radovan Karadzic, the self-described poet. Chris Merrill heads up the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Chris, you were reporting from the Balkans during the Bosnian War. You were introduced to Karadzic as a fellow poet. Tell us about that.
Well, I had wandered into the Hotel Intercontinental in Belgrade on New Year's Eve 1992 when a fellow journalist did me the favor of introducing me as a fellow poet to Karadzic, which gave me which opened the door for him to talk a little bit more than he might have been ready to speak to an American journalist. I used to joke with Bosnian friends that if only he had been given some sort of a literary award, maybe he would not have decided to go into politics. But he wasn't a great poet.
Well, I have a poem here in front of me. It's called Sarajevo, and again, you know, he oversaw the siege of Sarajevo. He writes, the town burns like a piece of incense. If the smoke rumbles our consciousness, empty suits slide down the town. Red is the stone that dies, built into a house. The plague. You say that there was another line about a grenade that struck you. Did he try to romanticize war and what he was doing?
The fact is that he's one of those poets who managed to find that his poetic vision could become a political reality. He had an apocalyptic view of Sarajevo because in some ways he felt himself to be a bit of an outsider. He'd spent some time in prison for fraud and embezzlement. He really wasn't a great poet. And then in these poems, these dreamlike poems, he imagines Sarajevo under siege. And then, of course, some years later, Sarajevo is under a siege orchestrated by Karadzic and his henchman, Ratko Mladic.
Yeah, he writes, after the graph I just read, calm, the army of armed poplar tree marches up the hill within itself. The aggressor air storms our souls. And once you are human, and then you are an air creature. And, of course, you know, when he was young, he saw his country under siege from the Nazis and from communists. But, as you said, he then became the aggressor. You also write about having a Muslim poet friend in Sarajevo, just on the eve of the war. Tell us about that.
A wonderful poet who went to him in his role as a psychiatrist because she was losing her hair. He accurately diagnosed that what she was suffering from was anxiety. The anxiety had to do with the growing tension between the Bosnian Muslims and the Serbs, tensions that he himself was stoking at every turn. And as she said to me after the fact, in fact, he cured her. Karadzic cured her of her hair falling out, but then the siege began, and she began to suffer from other ailments, getting shot at in the streets, withstanding the shelling on a daily basis, all the sorts of things that came with the worst siege in modern history.
So he was willing to treat someone who he then would have forced out, presumably, of her neighborhood.
Well, this is what's so amazing about it all. You had poets, Serbs, Croats, Muslims, gathering together at the Writers' Union, who were friends in cafes together, all the way up until the war began. And then, of course, the war begins, and people find themselves in other places. I had a Bosnian Serb friend who stayed in the city during the siege, and he told me once that every piece that he wrote for Oslo Bijenja, the local newspaper, one of his brothers up in the hills, including one who was indicted as a war criminal, would fire a shot through the ceiling of his house. He said, if I were a more prolific writer, my house would look like a gingerbread house.
Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Chris Merrill runs the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. He's also author of Only the Nails Remain, Scenes from the Balkan Wars. Okay, still ahead today, a surgeon's love-hate relationship with new technology in the operating room. That's after the news, here and now. When your digital camera or your home theater system gets the better of you, that thing that was supposed to enhance your life actually makes it more frustrating. But it's no big deal, right? After all, it's not brain surgery. Well, what if it is brain surgery? Neurosurgeon Katrina Furlich says new technology absolutely helps her do her job in the operating room, but she says it can also get in the way. She calls this the fiddle factor. She even says some surgeons, as they get older, and she includes herself in this category, prefer the simpler operations that involve less, not more, high-tech equipment. Dr. Furlich writes about the fiddle factor in an essay in the August issue of Technology Review, published by MIT. She's also the author of Another Day in the Frontal Lobe, A Brain Surgeon Explores Life on the Inside. And she joins us from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say, it was a little unsettling reading about the fiddle factor. You're in the operating room and deciding, gee, where do we put the monitor? What about the camera? What about the cords? Is there going to be a full-scale meltdown, which is something that people don't want to think is on your mind while you're doing brain surgery?
I didn't mean to scare people. I wanted to kind of humanize the process and show people that the technology we use in some ways is very similar to the technology we use at home, and it's subject to breakdowns and little kinks here and there, but luckily we're able to get around those kinks in most situations.
Describe what it used to be like, because you talk about back in the 70s when brain surgeons did their work, there was sort of a sense of, gee, I think I got to go in here somewhere.
You know, what's really helped us more and more over the past couple decades is our imaging technology, you know, the ability to find small tumors, for example, that otherwise wouldn't have been seen on x-rays or other sort of equipment. You know, along with the imaging technology has given us great ways of navigating in the operating room. So we know somebody has a small tumor, but how are we going to zero in on that and be as accurate as possible? And that's the sort of technology that's really been exciting. But because it's complex, it also comes with its own set of fiddle factors, so to speak.
Right. We had CAT scans and then MRIs and then these really intense abilities to look inside. And that's what's complicated things. So give us an example of how, you know, you might be working and suddenly have to think for a second about a side effect of the technology.
You know, even from the simplest things like, you know, why isn't this working? Oh, someone forgot to plug it in. Oh, someone tripped over the cord. You know, very simple things that happen at home happen in the OR. Other problems like, for example, how do we know that it's accurate? If we are pointing with our wand at someone's head, how do we know that this is, you know, dead on? Or, you know, what if it's a few millimeters off? And we have to know when to rely on the technology wholeheartedly and when to rely more on our human skills.
Well, you mentioned the wands. I just want to stop there for a second, because back in the day, there was this sense of, well, I think the tumor's going to be on the left side somewhere. But now you have this navigational equipment, as you say, and you can, how does this work? It sounds like you can set up an image in a screen, and then with this wand, it acts as sort of a camera.
What we do is we have an MRI scan, a very detailed MRI scan done before the surgery. And while the person's getting the MRI, they have these special stickers on their head. Then in the operating room, we have to register those stickers with our navigation equipment. So let's say we have a left frontal lobe tumor. We use the wand to point somewhere in the vicinity of the left frontal lobe, and the system will show us exactly where it is. So it really helps us minimize the incision. It helps us really zero in without having to fish around, so to speak.
As you write, we've seen this on Grey's Anatomy.
Exactly.
But then the fiddle factor comes in. You have this great device, this wand, but if there's the slight wiggle, it's detected, you know, by the wand, and it jiggles the image that you're getting. So you have to stop and wait for somebody to see, did it come from the bed? Was it the head of the patient? Was it a clamp? And, you know, you have to sort of stand there and while somebody fiddles.
Exactly. When this navigation technology first came online, some of my more senior mentors said, well, wait a minute, this, you know, we can't rely on this because what's going to happen to our own three-dimensional understanding of the brain? You know, we used to have to rely on our judgment and, you know, how far to go and how many centimeters back and up and down. And, you know, the more senior people in nursery were worried, well, this is going to erode our human skills. And in fact, I recall a case I did with a very senior neurosurgeon. We were having a lot of difficulty with our navigation equipment, and it was a very sensitive case, a very small abnormality in the brain. So finally, he took his gloved finger and ran it over the surface of the brain and said, okay, here's the tumor. You can actually feel it. And it was so low-tech, we started laughing. Basically, his finger had done what our navigation system couldn't do.
Well, but this new technology also offers you other things that might seem nuanced, but they ultimately are very important. For instance, you don't have to work in as large an area. And that affects something that would seem silly, but it's not, the hair.
This is something that as a woman in neurosurgery, I've really tried to pound into my male colleagues who don't really care about hair. But for some patients, it's a big deal. But, you know, if you're able to really hone in on your target, you know, before the operation even begins. So let's say we have a frontal lobe tumor and we know exactly where we're going to make the bony opening, exactly where we're going to make the incision on the scalp. You can really minimize the size of the scalp opening, the size of the bony opening, and really be as minimal as possible, which means you shave less hair.
And you say that some of your patients, not knowing that, just completely shave their heads before they come in. It's sort of ritualistic, here's my head, and you don't want them to do that.
Exactly. And in fact, I have a great example of a high school girl that we were operating on who had long, beautiful hair, and she was under the impression that a lot of it was going to have to go. But I convinced the senior surgeon that I was working with, wait a minute, there is a way of being really minimal here. And he was bald, so he didn't really care about the hair. But I said, well, if you don't mind, I'll do this first part of the operation. I'll do a very minimal hair shave. And when she woke up and could barely see the incision and looked almost as she had before the surgery, she was more thrilled about her hair than she was that we had taken out her tumor successfully. She was just so thrilled about her hair that it made all the difference.
Well, in fact, you believe something that simple can speed recovery, you know, if she looks less like a patient after surgery. Well, we've been talking about the fiddle factor in brain surgery, and Dr. Furlick, you started a new company to design simpler medical devices, you say, to reduce the time surgeons spend fiddling with new technology. But you're also writing a novel with a surgical theme?
I'm really intrigued by the idea of enhancing the mind. And, you know, it's a real trend these days to focus on brain fitness, which I think is a very encouraging trend. But what I see coming around the corner in brain surgery is actually using creative stimulation techniques to enhance the mind. So not just using stimulation for, say, Parkinson's disease, which is done today, but using it to enhance memory, for example. And as we learn more and more about the brain and about how the brain works and the networks that are involved in memory and language, it is foreseeable. I think it is around the corner that we can use stimulation techniques to enhance the mind.
So that as we age, people might, instead of going for Botox, go for a little needle in the brain?
Yes, I call it a brain lift.
That just opens up, I mean, now I can see why you want to write a novel about it, because do you worry about some of the sociological questions there? Who gets the brain lift? Do only people who can afford it get their memories back? I mean, a lot
you
of questions.
You hit the nail on the head. Yep, it's ethically challenging, and I think, you know, just like plastic surgery, people worry about those questions, and the same will be true for brain lifts.
Neurosurgeon Dr. Katrina Furlick. And by the way, we'll link you to her essay on the fiddle factor in brain surgery in Technology Review at our website, here-now.org. Dr. Furlick, pleasure to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, just a quick reminder, you can always listen to our show stream live at our website, here-now.org. And while there, download a podcast. Be our guest, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, time now for some of your thoughts and gentle corrections. We recently said that Barack Obama, if he were inaugurated, would be 47 at the time, only 4 years older than JFK, who I called the country's youngest candidate ever elected when he was 43. Well, Linda Gunn of Elkins Park, Pennsylvania writes, well, wait a minute, Teddy Roosevelt was a whippersnapper at age 42 when he was inaugurated, which, by the way, makes Obama a veritable graybeard. Well, right you are, Linda. Teddy Roosevelt was 42, but he wasn't elected at 42. He took office then after the assassination of William McKinley. Do you remember the kids from the Atrium School in Watertown, Massachusetts? As a class project, they were trying to get city governments to widen their paper margins to save trees.
If everyone in the U.S. changed the margins, we would save 6,156,000 trees.
Well, the kids said few cities and towns had joined them, but right after the piece aired, they heard from Jim Hunt, Chief of Environmental and Energy Services for the City of Boston, who called them to say that, in fact, because of them, Boston had changed the margins. All computers at Boston City Hall were reset in early May. In our recent story on bees, we said there'd been a gift of $150 million toward bee research at Penn State. Wouldn't that be terrific? But as Lee Wright points out, it was actually a gift of $150,000. And I recently used the phrase, corn as high as an elephant's eye. Well, Ben of Charlotte, North Carolina, but formerly of Indiana, wrote, corn is high as an elephant's eye at the end of summer. What you meant was knee high by the 4th of July.
I got a beautiful feeling and rhythm's going my way.
Well, we spoke recently with Hannah Rosen of the Atlantic Monthly about what researchers are calling an unintended consequence of the housing program called Section 8. It was intended to move people from crowded inner-city public housing by giving them subsidized housing vouchers to move to the suburbs. Well, the researchers said that because of a lack of services and available housing in the suburbs, the violence and problems of the inner city often moved with the voucher recipients. Well, Lisa Davidson of Newton, Massachusetts, called to defend the program.
I live in Section 8 housing, which is just a condo with some disabled neighbors, but a lot of younger professionals. And it's wonderful because Section 8 housing allows disabled and elderly people to live right in regular community housing, not just project housing.
We, of course, also recently covered the firestorm over the New Yorker cover picturing the Obamas as Muslim flag-burning militants. The editor of the magazine said people should know it was meant as satire of right-wing attacks. But Ron Skinner of Providence, Rhode Island, wrote, children will see the cover. I cringe to think they'll be asking their parents, why are the Obamas burning the American flag? It seems the only fair place for the New Yorker to go now is to show Senator John McCain in an Alzheimer's unit with his wife drunk on the inherited money flowing from vats of her family brewery beer. Well, remember when we spoke with Dr. Elizabeth Epperly, an Anne of Green Gables scholar at the University of Prince Edward Island. She was on her way to an Anne of Green Gables conference, which included an Iranian scholar. She reports back, according to him, some 80% of the people of Iran know the movie of Anne of Green Gables and love its heroine. She says it was fascinating to see pictures of young women in burqas with red braids over them while they acted out Anne of Green Gables to learn English. And finally, we spoke recently with David Gracer of Sunrise Land Shrimp in Rhode Island, who's advocating that Americans eat more insects, which he says are delicious, nutritious, and easier to produce than, say, cows. To test his theory on the delicious part, our intern, Hamid Ahmed, ate a bug because, frankly, I didn't want to.
It's a little bit like smoked sand.
To which Steve Follinsby of Haverhill, Massachusetts responds, Terry Gross would have eaten that cricket. Ouch, you really know how to hurt a girl. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. When we come back, the American teens on screen in a new riveting documentary. That's in 1 minute, here and now. The new documentary, American Teen, follows five of them through the halls of Warsaw Community High School in Warsaw, Indiana, over the course of their senior year. There's Hannah, an artistic loner, Colin, the jock desperate for a college scholarship, his friend Mitch, Megan, the queen bee with a wicked sting, and Jake, the marching band member who just can't get a date.
I don't know what it is about me. Maybe it's the monotone or the insane collections of video game characters and the band and all the stuff that makes me a super geek. But I don't know, it might be my face or the way I carry myself, or I don't know what it is, but they avoid me at all costs.
No. American Teen was an audience favorite at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. Director Nanette Burstein says she could relate to a lot of the emotions evoked, insider, outsider, sometimes both at the same time. The movie is incredibly intimate. Hannah, the loner whose mom has mental illness, has a sort of breakdown of her own. Megan, the homecoming queen, is almost arrested for spray painting a homophobic slur. We asked director Burstein why the kids let her document them.
Well, I was around for a long time. I spent an entire school year there and became very close to the teenagers. And one of the things that I do with my films is I allow that intimacy between myself and the subjects of the movie so that they will feel comfortable and they can expose some of their vulnerabilities on camera that make them, you know, so relatable to the audience.
They're also familiar to us. Now, I'm sure you've heard this. Variety said the film's going to be a hit, but they questioned this, you know, what they called stereotyping. But I'm wondering, was that what you found, that these sort of cliches are hardwired in high school?
Yeah, I mean, I found it when I went to high school myself. I found that all of these archetypes that we see in fiction films all exist in reality. The difference is that they're not the stereotypes in reality. They're far more complicated, and what I was doing was actually breaking them down. I mean, what kids hate more than anything is to be labeled, and that's all they are when they're that age.
Well, let's take Megan, the prom queen, sadistic as she rules her followers. But then we see her backstory. Here she is talking to her father about the pressure she feels to get into Notre Dame, his alma mater.
Is this pressure yours or your friends?
Mine and yours.
Okay. If you'll be disappointed for you, that's fine, but you shouldn't be disappointed for me. You're not doing this for me. I like Notre Dame. Your brothers and sister like Notre Dame.
There's just a lot of pressure.
And in addition to college pressure, she's lost a sibling?
Yeah, she has a horrible family tragedy not so far in her past that haunts her and brings out this rage in her that she then puts upon her peers. And she actually is dealing with some very heavy issues that you would have no idea, and probably her peers, most of them have no idea, and they have one perception of her.
And this is where, too, I actually disagree with one of the criticisms of the film, that it is so much a template of, you know, every high school experience going back decades, that it isn't about kids today. I disagree, because one of the things that you show so clearly is how much technology has changed their lives and sort of exacerbated high school problems, so that when they gossip about each other, they do it text messaging, and there's a girl's picture, she's bare-breasted, and it is around that school. In seconds, it's viral, you know, on their cell phones, and that's devastating to this girl.
Absolutely. Technology changes. It makes the cruelty harsher. It makes you have to be more cautious, but you're not cautious at that age. So
right.
Things are so much more regrettable, and communication is so overwhelmingly fast, and you don't have time to think or prepare yourself or protect yourself.
Hannah, for us, emerges as the star of the film, which also upsets the laws of high school, because Hannah describes herself, you know, as an outsider. Let's listen.
Warsaw's such a conservative town, and I'm so not conservative. I don't fit in. I hate it. I like music, I like film, and I like photography and art.
You know, it's funny, when I first met Hannah, I said, this is the coolest girl in the school, but clearly nobody else knows it.
Yeah.
And she won't know it until she's in college or out of college. And you know, it's not unusual. A lot of these special kids, I think A, they're not willing to play along with certain game and certain rules, so they stand out, and thus they're not part of the power structure, nor do they ever care to be part of the power structure either. So
we mentioned Colin, the jock, the star of the basketball team, who just breaks down at the pressure that's put on him to get a scholarship. And this is where the film turns into Hoosiers, for which we won't go right into the finale there. But his friend Mitch, I found really interesting because he's a kid from the inner clique you were hoping would see Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
And he does.
He does. And it brings out, as he says, his inner nerd. And, it's amazing. You feel like some of this stuff, it seems like it's written because you can't imagine this stuff happens in real life, and it does. You know, here's this gorgeous, super popular guy who falls for this other gorgeous girl, but she's not super popular, and
right,
and his peers are very threatened by his affection for this outsider.
Well, you just said something. You know, you feel like it had been written. There are people who have said, oh, come on, you had to have staged some of this. It's too much that Mitch would have fallen for Hannah. Did you stage any of this? Did you script any of this?
No. It's all very real. It all happened. This is, and the kids would tell you the same.
There was no structuring of, you know, what the kids would do by you or the other filmmakers?
No. There is certain structure in the style of the film. I mean, most of it's handheld. You know, there's certain directorial choices I make, you know, when they're on the bed thinking and I put them in a beautiful tripod shot, or, you know, they're walking through the park, and that is a more set-up shot. But 90% of the film is in the moments and the scenes and the interaction, and that is all very real and spontaneous.
You make this film in an era where kids are used to filming themselves. They don't even need you, a filmmaker. You know, they film themselves and put themselves on YouTube, and they have MySpace pages. I'm wondering if that's maybe why they feel so relaxed that people are even questioning if it's real on the screen. And you have thoughts about that, how open they are to having all their lives on screen.
Yeah, they have grown up in a different generation. They grew up with video cameras. Because of that, and because they watch TV where people are analyzing themselves a lot, they are, in some ways, seem more precocious than I remember being as a teenager, and they can articulate what they're feeling so much better as well. Now, that doesn't make them any less vulnerable than we were, but they can at least articulate what's going on with them, whereas I don't remember being able to do that at that age.
We don't want to give away some of the endings because there's all this, you know, it plays out dramatically. But we urge you to sit through the credits because we see the epilogue, and now in college they reflect back on their high school selves. They all had an arc. They all grew.
They did. They've all grown up a lot. And their comments about themselves have been since they've seen the film, too, and could reflect back on how they were in high school.
Some of what they might see on screen, and I'm thinking of Megan, they might not be very proud of.
I was very worried about her seeing the movie and how she would respond and make her feel badly at all or have any regrets about what I captured. And she didn't feel that way. She felt it very honestly depicted her, and she's happy with it.
Well, because it's in her past.
Exactly. She can look on this and say, this is 2 years ago in my life. I was in high school. None of us are angels in high school. And
she's grown.
Yeah.
That's director Nanette Burstein. Her new film is American Teen. It follows five teenagers from Warsaw, Indiana, through their senior year. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Nanette, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show.